there's enough rumor mongering, and we hear that, you know, it's going this way or it's going that way, people are going to make some life-changing decisions.
Workers at Eielson Air Force Base want more information on the realignment proposal. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, February 27th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, students in Talkeetna help prepare roadkill moose for food shelters.
It was just like, here's your knife, here's the table, start cutting.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Primera Blue Cross Blue Shield of Alaska, providing quality health plans to companies and individuals in Alaska for over 60 years. More at primera.com. Primera Blue Cross Blue Shield of Alaska. We know the territory. The State of Alaska Department of Revenue reminds you to file online now for your 2012 PFD and consider sharing a portion of your dividend through Pick, Click, Give or contributing to a college savings plan. More information at pfd.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska.
A Fort Wainwright-based soldier will face court-martial in the death of a fellow Stryker Brigade member in Afghanistan. Charges against Sergeant Travis Carden, including maltreatment, assault, and reckless endangerment, have been referred to court-martial in connection with the death of Private Danny Chen last year. Chen, who was the victim of severe hazing by fellow soldiers, was found dead of an apparent self-inflicted gunshot wound in a guard tower at base in Afghanistan on October 3rd. Carden of Fowler, Indiana, is one of eight Fort Wainwright-based soldiers facing charges related to Chen's death. Community leaders have begun compiling data they say will prove the Air Force won't save money by moving an F-16 fighter squadron and up to 1,500 military and civilian workers from Eielson to Anchorage, but base employees are still worried. Eielson's civilian workers want to know more about the proposed realignment. KUAC's Tim Ellis reports.
Like hundreds of his co-workers at Eielson, Lawrence Chapin was caught by surprise when the Air Force announced on February 3rd that it's planning to move the F-16 squadron, Eielson's central mission, to Elmendorf-Richardson. Chapin says neither he nor any of his co-workers had heard anything that would lead anyone to anticipate the proposed move, and he says he and his co-workers haven't heard much since from base officials about what led up to the decision or what civilian workers should do now.
Three emails, I think, were generated about some events, you know, and it was the very basic framework. You know, there has been very little official, a real statement to the civilian workforce or to the active duty. You know, it's kind of just a blanket statement, an email that went out, not from the wing commander, but from a deputy saying, hey, this is going on. And it was just kind of like a statement. And it was like, and stay the course. Remember to do the best that you can every day.
Ed Constantine, Eielson's top civilian personnel officer, says he and other base officials have passed along all the information they have to the employees. He says Eielson officials will pass along more information as it becomes available.
There's been a proposal made to move the F-16s, but there's nothing firm. There's no hard decisions been made. And until that happens, we really can't brief the workforce on anything because right now there is nothing happening.
Constantine says base officials aren't withholding any information, and they know there's a lot of concern among the civilian workforce. But he says for now, they just don't have any more to say.
Our workforce is important to us, so we try to keep them informed of things as we know. Right now, that's what we know.
Chapin says he understands all that. He's an Army veteran who was stationed at Fort Wainwright and served in Southwest Asia before he got out of the service and moved to North Pole and began working at Eielson as a civilian 11 years ago. Like a lot of other folks, he saw what happened in 2005 when the base was threatened with shutdown as part of the last base realignment and closure process. Chapin says he's hearing some of the same concerns now as he did back then. He says that's why base officials should be more forthcoming with civilian employees this time, if for no other reason than shutting down the rumor mill, which is running on overdrive these days.
When word of the BRAC hit the streets here, you had some people educated. Some people high up in the Air Force that immediately put their house out for sale to dump it as fast as they can to try and get ahead of that wave. And they ended up not bracking, and they were like, well, I want my house back. Well, you know, it doesn't work that way in real estate. And that's what I just hope that it doesn't get to that point where if there's enough rumor mongering, and we hear that, you know, it's going this way or it's going that way, people are going to make some life-changing decisions. Meeting some of those questions head-on would be a good way to go.
The president of Eielson's Federal Employees Union Local says he's heard a lot of those same questions from base employees. AFGE Local 1836 President Rick Jansen says the workers mainly want to know how Air Force Brass came to this decision and where do we go from here.
You know, they're willing to stay and do their job in an outstanding manner that they always do, but they just kind of want to know what's the Air Force's plan.
Jansen says he thinks it's unlikely that base officials will have much more to say until after the Air Force sends a survey team to Alaska next month to get an on-the-ground look at the situation.
They haven't even had their economic impact study team come up here, and they're scheduled next month. So until that happens, I don't foresee management saying much of anything.
In Delta, I'm Tim Ellis.
The Senate Education Committee is ready to pass a bill expanding the number of pre-kindergarten programs in local schools across the state. The measure would allow, but not require, any school district to expand early education to 4- and 5-year-old children, as long as it is optional and only half-time. It follows a 2-year pilot program in 6 school districts that included some 300 children. Those pupils were favorably rated on 3 separate national standards. One of the bill's co-sponsors, Anchorage Democrat Hollis French, said those tests showed that children in the program were placing as much as 2 years ahead of their expected levels.
Every piece of data that I've seen shows this works. The only thing that's left out there, I think, are some anecdotes about putting kids to school too early or socializing them too early. And you hear sort of lots of anecdotes about this or that reason. But the proof is here that this is what we need to do.
French also pointed to studies presented at the Crime Summit held at the Capitol earlier this year. At that series of hearings, he says the Washington Institute for Public Policy and Alaska's Institute of Social and Economic Research showed the positive effects of early education.
Children, as they grow up, they're much more likely to complete high school. That makes sense. They're more likely to have higher paying jobs. That makes sense. They're going to graduate from high school and much less likely to end up in the criminal justice system. Early childhood education programs are shown to save the state far more money than they cost as children move through school and into adult life.
At the summit, researchers reported that the state would save $6 for every dollar spent on early education and that the crime rate could be reduced by 16%. The Department of Education asked for time to amend its statewide cost projection for the program, expected to come in at about $41 million, and to determine if adding the programs will have any effect on the settlements of rural school litigation earlier this year. The bill will come up again Wednesday, where it is expected to pass. The state has a chance to protect anglers' access to fishing streams under a bill that unanimously passed the Senate today. The bill, by Anchorage Democrat Les Guerra, passed the House last year with no opposition. Guerra says that some of the state's prime fishing locations, such as the Salcha River and the Anchor River, have several miles of shoreline that, when they are developed, will keep the public out. The bill requires the Departments of Fish and Game and Natural Resources to inventory streams and rivers, and although the bill does not provide any money for the project, it opens the option of purchasing rights of way to them. Anchorage Democrat Bill Willikowski says the goal is to assure the public's legal access to streams.
As more and more land gets developed, we as citizens are going to lose public access. This bill encourages the Department of Natural Resources to look at those places where the public could lose access and seek low-cost easement purchases before those lands are developed rather than after, when they become very expensive to buy.
And Anchorage Republican Liesl McGuire said it serves a good purpose and avoids the state using its powers of eminent domain in the future.
It forces the department to be proactive and to really think about access for our citizens to these areas along the streams where we want to enjoy this really important quality of our life.
The bill next goes to the governor's desk. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, taking a look at an alternative ticket being offered this year for elections. That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Doyon Limited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oil field services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com. And by Wells Fargo, providing financial tools and resources for purchasing a home or planning for the future. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A.
Three Seattle fishermen were rescued last night after their vessel went aground on Umnak Island. The crew of the Neptune 1 called the Coast Guard at 11:21 p.m., alerting them that their boat had lost propulsion and gone adrift in rough weather. 25 minutes later, the Neptune 1 was on the rocks, and the crew had to swim to shore in their survival suits. After receiving the Mayday call, the Coast Guard launched a helicopter from St. Paul Island to rescue the fishermen. As the helicopter crew traveled down to Umnak, the FV Alaskan Enterprise also responded to the incident. That vessel was 25 miles away at the time, and it diverted course to shine a light on the Neptune 1 and its crew until the Coast Guard arrived. According to Petty Officer David Mosley, the Jayhawk helicopter arrived just after 3 a.m. and was able to safely transport the three men to Unalaska. He adds that the crews of the Neptune 1 and Alaska Enterprise took all the right measures to ensure a successful rescue.
You know, without the Mayday call for help, without the guys on the fishing vessel taking care of themselves by activating their EPIRB, putting on their lives, their survival suits, and without the help of the Alaska Enterprise crew, this may not have gone so smoothly, and these gentlemen may have been in worse shape than they ended up being.
The 58-foot vessel remains beached on the northwest side of Umnak Island. The vessel was carrying an unknown quantity of fuel, but so far there have been no reports of pollution. While Republicans squabble about their choice for a presidential candidate to go head-to-head against Democrat Barack Obama, a third-party process has quietly gained ground through the internet. Americans Elect offers an alternative to the standard primary process by allowing voters to choose presidential and vice presidential candidates through voting on an internet site. The tickets selected to run against the major party's candidates will appear on Alaska's November ballot. KSKA's Ellen Lockyer has more.
Americans Elect Chief Operating Officer Elliot Ackerman says his organization has gained a place on the ballot in 40 states. The online voting process is a simple one. Voters not happy with the way major party candidates are chosen can simply write in a vote for an alternative candidate through Americans Elect's website.
We are paving the way for an independent candidate to run for the presidency in 2012, and we're inviting every registered voter in this country to participate in having a voice in determining who that independent candidate's going to be.
Ackerman calls Americans Elect a second nominating process. It's a national internet caucus through the Americans Elect website, and the winners will be on the ballot, Ackerman says, in all 50 states come November. He says the method allows citizens to vote without having their voice diluted through partisan interests.
The spirit behind this effort is trying to get independent leadership into the White House. That's leadership that isn't from the two major parties.
Ballot access laws differ from state to state, Ackerman says, and it is no small feat to get on those ballots.
We at Americans Elect have been circulating petitions across this country, and nearly 3 million Americans have signed those petitions, and that's just to have more choice on the ballot. So this is about opening up what's a closed process.
The internet primary voting will take place in May and June of this year. So far, candidates John Huntsman, Ron Paul, and Buddy Romer are among those up for consideration on the Americans Elect website.
You know, right now people are saying who they'd like to see run. But when we get into May, we're going to have our first round of balloting, and that will whittle this field down to 6 candidates. And then we're going to go into June to a final round of balloting, and those 6 candidates will turn into 6 tickets, president and vice president. And those 6 tickets will go through another round of balloting in June, and the winner of that will be on the ballot in all 50 states. And the The people who will be voting will be any registered voter in this country.
According to Ackerman, all votes will be independently verified. Only registered voters will be able to vote. He says voter rolls are public record in every state, so the legitimacy of votes will be confirmed through a series of questions. Internet primary oversight will be handled by Americans Elect, although general election oversight is through the individual states. The Americans Elect process is legal in the state of Alaska. State Division of Elections Director Gail Fanumiai.
They are a qualified, limited political party for the purpose of presenting names to the Division of Elections for the office of president and vice president for the November 2012 general election.
Fanumiai gave Americans Elect the go-ahead last July.
They filed a petition and had 5,707 signatures. 4,818 of them were qualified. They needed to get at least 3,273.
She says although neither internet voting nor write-in votes in primary elections are legal in the state of Alaska, the presidential candidates selected by Americans Elect will appear on Alaska's general election ticket this fall. To remain on the ballot in the future, their presidential candidate must receive at least 3% of the votes cast for U.S. president on November 6th. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Backers of biomass energy pitched wood pellet heat as a money saver during a legislative hearing last week. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
Alaska Energy Authority staff and others talked to the House Committee on Economic Development about the Southeast Alaska Integrated Resource Plan. The document recommends developing more pellet heat as well as some expanded hydroelectric generation. AEA Biomass Program Manager Devani Plentovich says high fuel prices have driven many residents to heat with electricity instead of oil.
Unfortunately, as we've switched so much to the space heating, we've seen the reserve hydro just disappear at a remarkable rate, to the point where our utilities are having to supplement the hydro during the winter season with diesel generation, and that's very high-cost diesel generation.
Southeast lawmakers and other officials have called for more hydro projects with more connections to more communities. But the resource plan calls for a larger focus on wood heat in businesses, offices, and schools. And some are already making the switch. Plentovich says wood pellet heat costs less than oil-powered systems and have about the same price tag as electric ones. And, she says, boiler conversions are short-term investments.
The Sea Alaska building, that's going to pay back in about 4.5 years. The Cake School, if that gets funded through the Renewable Energy Fund, that's got about a 6 to 7 year payback. The Coast Guard in Sitka is looking at about a 5 year payback. So these projects have a good economic story.
Energy Authority staff say pellets would be a better deal if a manufacturer opened in Southeast. Now, most are shipped in from British Columbia, and that increases the cost. Ketchikan's Tongass Forest Enterprises is developing a pellet plant in Ward Cove. It's producing test batches now, with plans to supply local boilers. But several Prince of Wales Island groups have had less success. One, Alaska Mills LLC, shelved plans due to a high investment risk. Another, involving small mill owners, has not been able to find financing. AEA project manager Jim Strandberg says low timber harvests are also a barrier to regional pellet production.
One of the major issues in Southeast Alaska is the ability to harvest timber. Since much of the land here is owned by the U.S. Forest Service, access will be a key driver in the ability to develop local industries.
Many of those involved in biomass say the wood from pellets would come from mill waste or logging leftovers. The regional energy plan drew criticism at a House Resources Committee hearing earlier this month. Some speakers wanted stronger support for new hydroelectric development and a larger power grid. Authors say the plan realistically considered the needs of a region where little population growth is expected. This is Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking a variety of tire chains from passenger vehicles to heavy equipment, on the web at arcticwirerope.com. And by Crowley, providing tanker escorts, fuel delivery, and energy support services to Alaskans for nearly 60 years. From Valdez to the North Slope, Crowley knows Alaska. CrowleyAlaska.com.
Recent data from the U.S. Census shows that more than 9% of Alaskans live below the poverty line. KDLG's Mike Mason has the story.
The Alaska Department of Labor and Workforce Development recently published an article that examines poverty in Alaska. It shows that between 2006 and 2010, 9.5% of Alaskans lived in poverty. That's basically the same as the 9.4% poverty rate recorded during the 2000 census. Alaska's poverty rate of 9.5% is quite a bit lower than the 12% rate in Washington State and the 14% rate in Oregon. Nationally, the poverty rate stands at 13.8%. The new article from the Alaska Department of Labor and Workforce Development further breaks out the poverty data for Alaska. For instance, 6.6% of all families in Alaska fall below the poverty rate, while only 2.6% of married couples without children are in poverty. 22.6% of families with just a mother as the head of household fall under the poverty threshold, and that percentage jumps up to 41.4% if children are under the age of 5 years old. The Alaska Department of Labor reports that Alaska's lower poverty rates are mostly the result of the state's relatively high per capita income, which ranked 9th in the country in 2010. The department notes that children make up 26% of the population in Alaska, but they make up about 37% of those who live under the poverty level. The poverty rate among Alaskan natives is 21.6%, while those who identified themselves as white have a poverty rate of 6.5%. In Dillingham, I'm Mike Mason.
As long as snows are deep and nights are dark, moose mingling in roadways is a fact of life everywhere in Alaska. With a higher than average number of moose killed in collisions with vehicles this winter, the Roadkill Salvage Program in the Mat-Su Borough is rotating through the list frequently. One name on the list is the Sioux Valley High School Moose Club. KTNA's Lorian Nettleton has the story.
When the loudspeaker announces there's a moose in the woodshop, students at Sioux Valley High know it's time to butcher wild game. The Sioux Valley Moose Club is in its first year, and already they've processed 5 roadkill moose through the state's salvage program. 10th grader Maddie Starbuck made her first visit to the Moose Club this week to help out. She's processed other animals before, including cows and pigs from her family's farm, but the moose, she says, was a little different.
It was a lot more muscly, and because, of course, moose have a lot of muscles, so it was kind of harder to get the muscles off and everything, but it was fun.
Yeah.
What about the bones? Are you bringing bones home for
your dogs? Yeah, we were actually just breaking the ribs and everything over there so we could take them home to our dogs.
Maddie's brother, Joseph, is in 7th grade. It was also his first time at Moose Club. He was one of the first to show up this week and was able to participate in all steps, from skinning the carcass to grinding and vacuum sealing the burger.
Well, it was kind of hard to do it because you had to like pull the fur away or whatever and try and get to the meat, and that was fun, but there's a lot of muscles and stuff like that, so yeah.
How many kids were in here when you got here today?
Well, when I first got here, I think there was only 2 kids, but they kept on arriving and arriving, and at the end it was a lot.
So since you were first here, did you kind of get to jump right in? And
yeah, it was just like, here's your knife, here's the table, start cutting.
Steve Harrison teaches PE at Sioux Valley, and he says the community support for the project has made a dream into a reality. The Moose Club received support from Talkeetna and Susitna Community Revenue Sharing Grants, which gave the club everything it needed to turn roadkill into a learning experience that also fills freezers around the community.
We got $11,000 through the Talkeetna and Sunshine Community Councils through that program, and we were able to fund the construction of our moose shed and also all the meat butchering supplies, including the grinder and vacuum sealer and sausage stuffer and everything that we need to process a moose, including a trailer that is specially designed with a winch on it, and we built a sled out of UHMW plastic that the moose fits on, and we just winch it right onto the trailer.
32 students are signed up for the Moose Club. On any given day, as many as 12 may show up to participate in the butchering and bagging. Harrison says any more than 8 kids at a time with knives in their hands can seem like a little bit much.
But we've been lucky to have plenty of help, you know, the whole time. And the kids, they love it. You know, they're learning how to do this stuff, and they're excited. They're, you know, looking at, they're seeing, you know, the different parts on the animal there, and have lots of questions and stuff. So it's great. Kind of neat one about this last moose we got last night. I picked it up really late, but it was hit by a train. But it was unfortunately there was a baby fetus moose inside of it. And I immediately called Mike Matthews. He was in here earlier helping. And he's not only the basketball coach, but he's the biology teacher. And so he was super excited to get that. It's in the freezer now so that he can show and do some biology lessons with his kids using you know, the fetus. So there's other opportunities. There's some good education opportunities that present themselves here.
It's normally a three-day operation that kids fit in mostly after school or during their free periods. But for this week's moose, most of the action took place during a half day of school. With plenty of kids helping, the whole process was completed from start to finish in one day. In Talkeetna, I'm Lorian Nettleton.
High winds in southeast this winter are wreaking havoc on land and at sea. The State Ferry Kennecott postponed a scheduled Gulf Cross voyage earlier in February due to heavy weather. The Kennecott is rated for open ocean travel. What kind of weather could keep it tied to the dock? On Friday, February 3rd, Sitka experienced sustained winds of 53 miles per hour throughout much of the morning and recorded a peak gust of 86 miles per hour. Meteorologist Joel Curtis with the National Weather Service in Juneau says he and his colleagues have been analyzing data from the Cape Fairweather Data Buoy. KCAW's Robert Woolsey recently spoke with Curtis about the recorded sea height offshore on that morning.
48, and actually, if you want to put decimals on it, was 48.6 feet.
Yeah, with decimals, like you're out there with a meter.
Yeah, that's absolutely insane. But why don't we say very close to 50 feet?
Oh, no ship is going to weather it particularly well.
No ship is going to weather it well. There's nothing on the ocean that is going to have a good day in a 50-foot sea. And oh, by the way, the period was 17 seconds.
Curtis called the wave height mountainous. Former Alaskan Ben Grossman is an Oscar winner. He won an award for groundbreaking work in visual effects in the Martin Scorsese-directed film Hugo. Grossman, who comes from Delta Junction, was one of four to win the award Sunday for Hugo in the Best Visual Effects category. Their group beat films including Rise of the Planet of the Apes and the last installment of the Harry Potter films in visual effects. Grossman grew up in a cabin in Big Delta and began attending the University of Alaska Fairbanks at age 16. In Fairbanks, he worked as a photographer for the Fairbanks Daily News Miner and a stringer for the Associated Press. He moved to California in 2001. To pursue film work. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Tim Ellis in Delta, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Alexandra Gutierrez in Unalaska, Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, Mike Mason in Dillingham, Lorian Nettleton in Talkeetna, and Robert Woolsey in Sitka. APRN's Dave Donaldson reported from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Fite. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking a variety of tire chains from passenger vehicles to heavy equipment, on the web at arcticwirerope.com.
And by
Crowley, providing tanker escorts, fuel delivery, and energy support services to Alaskans for nearly 60 years. From Valdez to the North Slope, Crowley knows Alaska. CrowleyAlaska.com. The Alaska Energy Authority announces the 2012 Commercial Energy Audit Program. Owners of eligible commercial buildings throughout Alaska, including nonprofits, may be reimbursed for qualifying energy audit. Go to akenergyauthority.org to apply online. Applications are due to AEA by Wednesday, March 28th. Energy efficiency is good for business. This message sponsored by the Alaska Energy Authority.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.